The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. You can be seated. First thing I want to tell you is welcome to the Fourth Circuit and relax. Yes, you can. I had a friend one time back home and he was trying a case. The jury was out and I saw him. I said, how are things going? He said, I don't believe I got much of a chance in this case. I said, why is that? He said, during my closing argument, one of the jurors stuck her tongue out at me. That ain't going to happen up here. Mr. Shapiro, I believe you have an introduction.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is David Shapiro. I represent the appellant, Mr. Wilcox, and with the Court's permission, I'll introduce Charlie Hogel. Mr. Hogel is a law student at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, duly qualified under Local Rule 46A.
Great. Thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing from Mr. Hogel. He's admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Hogel, whenever you're ready, we'll be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honors. It's a privilege to be here. May it please the Court, Charlie Hobel for Plaintiff Appellant Tori F. Wilcox. Mr. Wilcox is a Rastafarian who was prevented from attending congregate worship services, and when he filed the complaint in the district court dismissed his complaint at the screening stage on two apparent grounds: failure to state a claim and failure to exhaust administrative remedies. The record does not support either of those grounds. Mr. Wilcox did everything the law requires to exhaust his administrative remedies and to state a claim for relief under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. In his pro se complaint to the district court, Mr. Wilcox stated that the suspension of Rastafarian worship services for several months at Marion Correctional Institution resulted in, quote, deprivement of a reasonable opportunity to worship according to his Rastafarian tenets, beliefs, customs, and practices. That's at Joint Appendix, page 4. He also explained that the suspension caused a, quote, defacement of his faith, which is at Joint Appendix, page 8. And he attached to his complaint an affidavit, which pointed out that weekly worship services are important to Rastafari because it is, quote, clearly stated in Rastafarian doctrine that all Rastafarians are to observe the Holy Sabbath, which is the Saturday of every week. And that's at Joint Appendix, page 6. Finally, Mr. Wilcox submitted a document containing Sabbath guidelines, which are based on the Nyabingi ceremony, a ceremony that derives from the oldest sect of Rastafari. The document describes a Saturday congregation in which adherents come together to pray, sing, and read the Bible. That's at Joint Appendix, page 21. Thus, the complaint gives every indication that weekly worship on the Rastafari Sabbath is a vital part of Mr. Wilcox's religious exercise. In the past, this court has held that preventing prisoners from participating in communal religious services substantially burdens their First Amendment right to free exercise. In Jehovah v. Clark, decided in 2015, this court recognized the substantial burden on religious exercise under the First Amendment when the only work assignments realistically available to a prisoner conflicted with the prisoner's Sabbath schedule, making it impossible for the prisoner to both participate in a work program and observe the Sabbath. In Lovelace v. Lee, an oft-cited decision of this court, the court recognized a substantial burden on religious exercise when a disciplinary infraction prevented a Muslim prisoner from participating in the holy feast of Ramadan. The court also stated, in Lovelace v. Lee, that the Supreme Court's decision
What do you think the substantial burden is here? Failure to have the weekly meeting?
Your Honor,
he could pray all he wanted, right?
He could pray alone in his cell, Your Honor.
Pardon?
Alone in his cell, he could pray. He could pray, as far as we know.
He could pray all he wanted to, personally.
Right, by himself.
Right, but he was deprived of the weekly meetings on Saturdays.
Yes, Your Honor, the Sabbath celebrations.
And the does the record show that the state claims or the defendants claim that they didn't have anybody to run the meetings? They didn't have a chaplain.
Your Honor, what the record...
Is that fairly in the record, that they didn't have somebody to, like a minister or chaplain? Or, what do you call it in Rastafari?
Well, the Rastafari term is something along the lines of minister. I'm not sure, but what was really needed for the prison was
They didn't have anybody qualified.
Exactly, to run the service who was not...
You said several months. We're talking about, 3 months?
About approximately 4 months, I think, Your Honor, from September 12th to around mid-January.
I thought in December they said they had somebody.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. So for the first 3 months, approximately, the prison's explanation for why Rastafari services had to be closed was that there was no minister available to oversee the services. And then roughly mid to late November, a chaplain, newly hired by the prison, was available to oversee the services.
So when, in late November, the chaplain became available?
Became available.
So it's 2.5 months, or 2 months?
Well, after the chaplain became available, the prison continued to suspend the services.
Well, after the chaplain became available, I thought you said they had some excuse that the chaplain wasn't going to do it. But there was no chaplain for a couple of months.
Right. At first, there was no chaplain, and then, once the chaplain was available, there was...
But when did they file the complaint?
Shortly after the services were closed, Your Honor.
I'm not quite sure I understand your argument with respect to reversing the dismissal of the complaint as to Captain Mehenik. Is that how you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Mehenik, yes, Your Honor.
It was not clear to me from the record that he had anything to do with respect to the decision to terminate or not resume services.
Your Honor, it's certainly not clear from the record exactly what input Chaplain Mehenik had, but...
The determination, I believe, was made by Wilcox, was it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I'm sorry. The determination was made, the decision was made by Terrell. Was it not the decision not to resume services?
According to the record, an executive decision came down from Assistant Superintendent from Programs. Yes, Dwayne Terrell, who's one of the defendants.
Who's that?
One of the defendants in this case is this assistant.
No, who's that assistant superintendent?
Dwayne Terrell.
So that's who you're after.
Well, Your Honor,
You don't have a claim against that chaplain. He didn't do anything.
Well, Your Honor, we think that the district court prematurely dismissed the chaplain because there's not enough information on the record to determine what part he played here, and the district court's.
You've got to state a claim.
Well, the claim
liberally construed, you have to state a claim. I don't know what he did. You got somebody made a decision in there, and you don't want. You don't want an injunction.
Yes, Your Honor. Right.
Correct?
Correct.
And you don't want punitive damages. Correct?
We're not prepared to concede exactly that.
Well, I thought that was right. All right. And you don't want nominal damages. You want compensatory damages.
Well, Your Honor, the complaint leaves open the possibility of compensatory, nominal, and punitive damages future point. Yes.
So you're... The record, I thought my understanding of the record was that you wanted real damages and didn't have a claim for nominal and punitive.
Your Honor,
you didn't want an injunction. It's a 1983 case.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You know that. It's a 1983 case. And what you get in 1983 cases, primarily you're after damages from the individuals claiming they violated a clearly established constitutional right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying you do want nominal damages, and you do want punitive damages.
Yes, Your Honor. We want the damages determination. Mr. Wilcox, on Joint Appendix page 5, left it up to the court to determine the type and extent of damages that the court found would be warranted in this case. So right now, we're not closing off the possibility of punitive or nominal damages right now.
If you indicated, I believe it's your position, that Manette took actions that contributed to a constitutional violation. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint supports a reasonable inference.
What actions?
Your Honor, while Chaplain Menick initially was prepared to provide Rastafari religious services, he then reneged on...
There's no explanation even proffered or suggested that it would had any that it was a decision on his part, as opposed to a result of Mr. Terrell's decision that they would not be offered. There's nothing affirmative. Your formulation suggests that he took affirmative action in that regard. And there doesn't appear to be, that I saw, anything in the record of an affirmative action in that respect.
Your Honor, our key focus when it comes to Chaplain Menick is that what the district court found was the basis for dismissing him was that Chaplain Menick cannot be held responsible for following orders.
But we don't. And we're not limited to that as a grounds for affirmance. We can affirm.
Of course, Your Honor. Yeah.
So my question again is, what are you saying? What's your predicate for a suggestion that the chaplain took affirmative action that contributed to the constitutional violence?
Your Honor, Chaplain Menick was a professional involved in making decisions potentially at the prison, and right now
we asked about affirmative. You alleged affirmative actions that contributed to a constitutional violation.
Right now, Your Honor, the record supports an inference that he was involved in the decision-making process, and at this time,
you understand that's not my question. You're saying that it's not necessary
for. We do think that it's necessary for some form of affirmative action to be taken. We just don't know that the record at the screening stage is sufficient for the court to determine that there was no affirmative action, considering that the allegation was made in the complaint.
Before you run out of time, tell me what the basis is for liability against Mr. Brown, Chaplain Brown.
Betty Brown is the director of the head of the Office of Religious or Chaplaincy Services, and Mr. Wilcox stated in his complaint that Chaplain Brown authorized Superintendent Dwayne Terrell and Assistant Superintendent of Programs.
Did he actually did it, or that the office did it?
That the complaint alleges that Ms. Brown personally authorized Superintendent Terrell and Assistant Superintendent Teague. To close Rastafari religious services. And Your Honors, in terms of whether or not a substantial burden in this case could have been anticipated or should have been understood by prison officials to be the consequence of canceling Rastafari worship services, this court has stated that communal worship, in parentheses, group services and prayers, is among, quote, routinely allowed religious exercises, and, quote, expecting prison officials to recognize that the denial of routinely allowed religious exercises is a burden should not exceed their knowledge or understanding of religious practices. That's in Lovelace v. Lee at 189. The suspension of Rastafari worship services was, on its face, a substantial
burden. Is that your best case, the Lovelace case?
That's one of
the circuit right here. That's the one that you rely on primarily.
We rely heavily on Lovelace v. Lee, as well as a number of other decisions published in this circuit, which have found substantial burdens placed on prisoners who were prevented from attending communal worship services, Your Honor. For instance, in Miles v. Moore, this court recognized a substantial burden on religious exercise when a prison's disciplinary policy prevented the plaintiff from attending Christian worship services, and the prisoner stated in an affidavit his belief that, quote, church attendance is vital for Christian growth and development. In Parks L. v. Fleming, this circuit recognized a substantial burden on religious exercise when a Muslim prisoner was temporarily banned from attending chapel and thereby prevent it from observing a holy prayer service.
Well, they could do it if they had a reason, like safety or something.
Yes, Your Honor.
They could make a decision like that, right? I mean, the prison officials run the prisons. We don't.
Of course, Your Honor, yes.
They got a penological interest. They can do some things, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court's test from Turner certainly lays out factors that once a substantial burden or a violation of a free exercise right is established, there's a balancing test that the court can conduct to determine whether or not the offending regulation can be permitted to stand, and the existence of a legitimate penological interest is one of those factors.
Honestly. They argue that here, don't they?
Your Honor, the district court didn't conduct a Turner test, and possibly because there's really just not enough on the record for us to determine or to factor in all of those fact-heavy questions that the Turner test asks. Additionally, here, the prison hasn't established a legitimate penological interest based on the record itself. Certainly, the prison's attorneys have suggested that there was an absence of available chaplains to oversee weekly religious services, but there's no evidence that the absence or the evidence in the record. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
You can finish your answer.
Of course. Thank you, Your Honor. Because the fact that prison services remain suspended after a chaplain was available suggests that the absence of somebody to oversee the services can't really explain their suspension, at least not for the entire time they were suspended. And with that, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Hogle. Mr. Park.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ryan Park, and I'm from the North Carolina Department of Justice, and we represent, along with my colleague Kimberly Grandy, we represent the state defendants in this case. So appellant Tori Wilcox seeks $75,000 from four individual prison officials, including a prison chaplain, directly under the Free Exercise Clause, based on...
He says that they're claiming nominal damages and punitive damages, too. Do you understand that?
No, Your Honor. So as to punitive, that's very easy to address. So punitive damages requires willful or wanton conduct. The claim is that they negligently closed the prison. That's on J's services. That's on J4. He explicitly says it's a negligence claim. And there's no willful or wanton conduct. The complaint also specifically states that after a second chaplain was hired, or this is in a declaration attached to the complaint, after a second chaplain was hired, Rastafarian services resumed.
Eventually.
Correct, Your Honor.
But not initially, as was promised. So what penological interest was served by Terrell's executive decision to renege on his promise to resume services once the new chaplain was hired for some period of time?
Yes, Your Honor. So as a threshold matter... So there are two penological interests that are evident in the record. The first is, as the Smith v. Cotter case from the Third Circuit sets out, managing scarce financial resources
is... That's not responsive, okay? Stay with me. Terrell said that once the chaplain is hired, we will resume services, correct?
That is alleged in the complaint, yes.
When a chaplain is hired and he makes the executive decision not to do so for some period of time?
Yes, for about a month.
So what was the reason for that? And it's not to be found in other cases.
So this is... Go ahead.
What is the reason that we need from what we have before us to understand his determination not to do what he had said he would do? But he would have known that when he said he was going to resume services once a chaplain was hired. Until a chaplain was hired, There was no one to supervise. They had to have someone manage the services.
That's correct.
When a chaplain was hired, they had someone to manage the services. So what then was the reason for the executive decision not to do so?
So that is not evident in the record, Your Honor. I acknowledge that. But this is a pleading burden on the plaintiff, prisoner, and that's in the Jehovah case.
But he doesn't know why Carol reneged on his promise.
That's correct. He does not have that information.
He can't be presumed to know that. Only Carol can know why he didn't follow through.
I acknowledge that the actual evidence of why services did not resume for 4 weeks is not in the record. But more broadly, this is...
That would be a period from late November to middle of January?
So that's a period, correct, Your Honor, after the hiring of the first chaplain, Chaplain Menhinnick, to the resumption of services on January 14th the following.
And when was Menhinnick hired?
He was hired on November 20th, actually.
November 20th?
Yes.
To January the 14th?
That's correct.
There's no explanation in the record for why you wouldn't let this fellow go to his weekly meetings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And there's also there was no indication maybe that I can tell from the record when services were resumed. So as far as Wilcox knew, it could be indefinite.
As far as Wilcox knew when he filed the complaint, the pause could have been indefinite. But I'd like to talk very briefly about the actual substantial burden.
So the 14th, how'd that get into the record?
That was in a declaration filed by another inmate that was later...
Is that properly in the record? I mean, it's not in the complaint.
It's not in the complaint,
Your
Honor.
The complaint was filed before that.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. So as to the main substantial burden question, so the plaintiff wants this court to hold as a matter of law that weekly group congregational services are a central aspect of all religions. And that is simply not the case. It's common.
Yeah, that's
okay, go.
I don't believe that's what he alleged.
That isn't what he alleged.
So it is a common feature of many religions.
That isn't what he alleged. Okay, as a practicing Catholic, if I were to allege that canceling Sunday Mass would deprive me of a reasonable opportunity to worship according to my religious beliefs, you don't think that would be sufficient to state a claim?
It would be sufficient to state a claim if there were.
That's what he said. And it's pro se, and it's remarkably comprehensive, the B pro se. He does a pretty good job of explaining why his worship services are essential to his Rastafari faith.
Well, what he states in the complaint is that he was deprived of a reasonable opportunity to worship according to his beliefs. But that could, of course, be true of an incidental burden on a peripheral practice.
He asserts that all Rastafarians are to observe the Holy Sabbath, which is the Saturday of every week. And why is that not sufficient under a liberal pleading standard?
What the complaint lacks, including in the reference to the Holy Sabbath, is an allegation that group services are a component of...
Rastafarians are to observe the Holy Sabbath. I don't understand. You don't impose a higher pleading burden on a pro se plaintiff. And that's what you seem to be arguing.
So there are many cases involving pro se plaintiffs, many of which that...
He claims that he was deprived of a reasonable opportunity to worship according to the Rastafarian tenets, beliefs, customs, and practices.
So there are many cases, all of which Mr. Wilcox relies on, involving pro se complaints that set out in far more detail and far more particularity the religious practice that has... been alleged to have been restrained, including involving group services. So in the Lovelace case, for example...
Did you say that if you took out Rastafarian and put Christian in there, that wouldn't be enough?
So it would be enough if
a reasonable opportunity to worship according to my Christian tenets, beliefs, customs, and practices. You would say that's not enough?
It would be enough if it was accompanied by an allegation that group services...
It wouldn't be enough by itself.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you substituted Catholic, that wouldn't work either.
So to make the point from point A to point B, and that is our central objection to the pleading.
It's unclear. What were you not put on notice of?
That
he's complaining that he can't worship, and that's the point of the pleading standard, so that the respondent can formulate a response. What did the prison officials not know here on the basis of the
So they knew, of course, that he was requesting weekly group Rastafarian services, but the gap from that request and to a substantial burden on his exercise of religion is what Your Honor suggested, is your own understanding of what other religions with which other people are familiar with require. But there are many religions that do not have a common feature weekly group services.
So what specifically would he have had to say?
He would have had to say, as the pro se prisoner said in Lovelace, there are three general categories, Your Honor. So one are details of the actual practice, and the second would be some sort of understanding of its place within the religion, and third, so as in Lovelace, for example, he cited that it was that the Ramadan services were one of the five pillars of Islam. But in Krieger, for example, this court denied a free exercise claim based on the bare assertion that outdoor group worship sessions were required. It said that you have to allege more to explain how this is a central component of your religion. And I think what that gap illustrates, Your Honor, is that proper for this court to impose its own assumptions as to what religions do and do not require. There are, excuse me.
I would suggest that's what the respondent is doing. I don't know what the Rastafarian faith is. I only know based on his pleading that he alleges that he is denied the opportunity to worship according to the tenets of his faith. And I don't know, I didn't know at this stage what more specificity you would have required of him under a liberal pleading standard, but then I've said that before, so you're not.
So I think you're on, yes, I mean, there are a wide variety of ways that pro se prisoners have achieved this pleading obligation. It's not a high hurdle to say, for example, that as a practice Rastafarian in the past, I have engaged in weekly group services for X amount of time, or that this is the place within the religion that weekly services hold.
Nobody knew that it was weekly services?
Nothing is in the record as to...
Page JA6.
Yes, Your Honor.
It says, it is clearly stated in Rastafarian doctrine that all Rastafarians, I may be pronouncing it wrong, and I'm sorry if I do, are to observe the Holy Sabbath, which is the Saturday of every week. Is that, can you rely on that, or we rely on that? It's in the appendix here.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think that...
So that shows that the Holy Sabbath is the Saturday of every week. And in four lines above, they talk about the fact they couldn't engage in, you wouldn't allow weekly services. Weekly services. This is,
right.
I mean, you talked about this liberal pleading of pro se complaint.
Yeah.
What do we do with that? Disregard it? Did you move to strike? It's written at the top of that page. It says witness affidavit.
But yes.
It's in this record.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think the inferential leap this is a practice that I have been deprived of participating in, and this is a substantial burden. This is a central aspect of my religion.
No,
is what is
essential. It's the opportunity to worship according to the tenets of his faith, the tenets, beliefs, customs, and practices of his faith.
So there are a wide variety of cases, including Krieger. I'd point the court to the Leviton decision from the D.C. Circuit by Judge Garland, where he discussed a group of evangelical Christians who alleged they were, quote, required to sell T-shirts on the National Mall spreading the gospel, that it was something that emanated directly from requirements of their faith. And the court observed that there is a gap there between this is a practice I would like to engage in, and this is a central aspect of my religion. But Your Honor,
he's basically saying he goes to church every week, right? That the Rastafarians go to church every week, and it's the Sabbath is Saturday. If that's apparent there in the paper.
Yes, Your Honor. That's
not anything out of the ordinary.
A lot
of denominations have weekly services.
Exactly. So I acknowledge it. It's not out of the ordinary, but we do not know, and I personally do not know, what Rastafarian services...
Well, it says it right here on this page 6. They're to observe the Holy Sabbath, which is the Saturday of every week. And talking about their weekly services.
So I see
What about that? Could they not understand in the complaint? Or the complaint?
Or
a pro se plaintiff?
I'm not making headway with this argument.
I'm trying to give you a chance to make some headway with it. Most of these things, pro se complaints, we throw out a lot of them.
Yep.
They're not sufficient.
Right. I mean,
the question is whether this one falls in that category.
The best that I can say, Your Honor, is that...
So don't give up. Keep after it.
The best that I can say, Your Honor, is that there is a gap between point A, I was not allowed to engage in weekly services, and point B, which...
I'm going to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
His complaint is, you let Rastafarians have weekly services, you let Christians, you let Muslims, you let other services, but you let Rastafarians have weekly services, and then you stopped. Now, can't we infer from the fact that you let Rastafarians have weekly services, that his importance of that weekly participation with others is a legitimate tenet of his beliefs? I mean, you let Rastafarians have it, then you took it away just from them. But can't we infer from the fact that you let them have, that you let Rastafarians have these services, that the services are consistent with their beliefs and necessary to their tenets?
So I think that inference is supplied based on, which is a fair inference, I acknowledge it, is supplied based on judicial assumptions about what certain practices are and are not common features of religions. Buddhism, for example.
Do you understand his question? His question is very fact-specific. On the facts before us, is it not inferable prison officials recognized that Sabbath observance is a tenet of this man's faith because they had recognized and provided the opportunity for such services.
So that is a fair inference that this court can make.
Okay, so why, if you could maybe respond, and maybe that would be the headway that we're looking for.
So the best that I can say is that there are many religions that do not involve weekly services, and that the extension of
services to them. Are there other services, weekly services, that you provide to inmates who don't have that as a tenet of their faith?
I'm not aware of the in particular. What I will say, and this relates to the Turner balancing analysis, and this is directly from the Supreme Court's decision in Alone, which is that when there are alternative means of engaging in a practice, for example, here the plaintiff was freely available to seek the prison's assistance in identifying a volunteer inmate leader. He did not do so. There are a wide array of other alternative means for him to exercise his religion that...
Wait. You said he didn't do these things. Where's that in the complaint? This thing about he could have sought another leader. Where's that?
So that
this is 12b-6 now.
Correct.
It seems to me that's a defense that might appear in an answer, but not at the 12b-6 stage.
So the district court, we believe, properly took judicial notice of the government of North Carolina prison regulations, which allowed at that time for him to seek assistance.
And how do you take judicial notice of the fact that he didn't?
That's fair. That is not in the complaint. If I could speak just for a few minutes about the PLRA and the physical injury requirement, because this case is ultimately about damages. Services have resumed and are ongoing, but there are two principles that govern.
You say it's primarily about damages? I thought it was all about damages.
It is all about damages, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And I thought you said it was all about compensatory damages.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's nothing about punitive damages, and there's nothing about nominal damage.
That's correct.
Yeah, I thought that's what you'd be up here arguing strong.
So if I could just use my remaining time to discuss that, Your Honor. So
go ahead.
I'm sorry. The parties agree that the PLRA was intended by Congress to be construed according to ordinary tort law principles. And under those principles, there is a rigid line between the violation of law on the one hand and the ability to recover money on the other. So you cannot recover damages under tort law based solely on the showing of negligence. You have to show actual causation of harm. And so as the majority of circuits have held.
Can you get damages against a public official in a 1983 case for mere negligence? In a 1983 case for mere negligence?
I'm not completely sure I know the answer to the question, Your Honor, so I don't want to. I'm happy to address it in the supplemental briefing, but
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you finish your answer? My question is, if you look at the facts that are alleged in this case, I don't see how it could possibly be construed as a negligence case. I mean, they're alleging that they intentionally did these things, intentionally took these acts, stopped these services. So frankly, although he uses the term negligence in his complaint, I'm not sure when you look at the facts, they are intended to establish what we would know as a claim for them.
So, but I guess I agree that's fair. But the PLRA requires more. The PLRA requires evidence of physical injury. And under the Section 907 of the Restatement of Torts, which Mr. Wilcox cites, unless there's been economic harm, claims for damages require physical or emotional harm. And
normally, you're right. But when there's a First Amendment violation, don't we have case law that says that the damages there are different, that situation is different, that you don't actually have to have the traditional form of damage?
So that issue has not been resolved definitively in this circuit, Your Honor.
You're saying that the Congress can curtail the constitutional tort?
The Congress may curtail the availability of money damages for constitutional torts, which is the ordinary constitutional rule that under Ex parte Young, that injunctive relief is available under RLUIPA, and we do not contest that. But to receive money damages from individual prison officials, Congress may constitutionally impose additional barriers, and a physical harm barrier is the one they chose to impose in the PLRA.
Okay. Did you have any more questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hogle, you have some time remaining.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by pointing out that Mr. Wilcox did make it plain in his complaint that weekly services are important to his religious exercise, and there's nothing in the record to suggest otherwise. It's not up to defendants or to any court, including the district court, to say that he's simply wrong about his beliefs. Second, it's undisputed that cancellation of Rastafarian services continued for a matter of months following the hiring of a new chaplain.
Months? 2 months?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was any reason given for that or any indication given when the cessation would cease? when the services would resume?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to point to it.
So you say we're looking at a four-month period or a two-month period?
We're looking at an entire four-month period in which the prison's explanation for why the services were suspended changed at some point.
For the first 2 months, there was no chaplain.
Yes.
And after they hired a chaplain, there was no reason.
It was, we're just not doing it. Yes, Your Honor. Thus, based on the record, there's no basis after the hiring, as Your Honor pointed out, for continuing the suspension of services. And the record at least suggests that the absence of someone to oversee the services was a pretext. It's very difficult to draw anything from the record that suggests a legitimate penological interest in the cancellation, which is a vital prong, of course, of the Turner test, which we get to once we determine that a substantial burden exists. And that's quite clear here. Returning to the question of whether or not attending religious services on the Sabbath is central to Mr. Wilcox's religious exercise. The Supreme Court has repeatedly and in many different contexts stated that courts must not presume to determine the place of a particular belief in a religion or the plausibility of a religious claim. Other circuits have found the same thing. The Sixth Circuit has stated that neither RLUIPA nor the First Amendment permits governments or courts to inquire into the centrality of a faith to a faith of certain religious practices. 11th Circuit in Watts v. Florida stated that it is beyond the competence of the courts to determine the centrality of a particular religious belief or practice. The test is sincerity, not centrality. Here, the record clearly indicates Mr. Wilcox's sincere belief in the importance of attending Sabbath worship services, and that's exactly what was denied him here. When it comes to the physical injury requirement under the PLRA, as Judge Traxler pointed out, there is law in this circuit. Piver v. Pender County Board of Education, which was decided in 1987, states that injury to a protected First Amendment interest can itself constitute compensable injury wholly apart from any emotional distress, humiliation, personal indignity, or, I'll end the quote there, but other forms of emotional injury suffered by plaintiffs. There's a logical distinction in the good law of this circuit between a First Amendment injury and an injury to one's emotions or mental state. That distinction exists in traditional tort law as well. It can be found, it's discussed at length in appellant's my brief, pages 11 through 20, discuss this issue. Tort law distinguishes between mental and emotional injuries. And
can you speak up?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, just speak directly into the mic. You tend to...
Didn't mean to murmur at you. Yes. The 2nd, 6th, 7th, and 9th circuits have held the same thing. I'm going to point out here that there is a logical distinction between an injury to liberty under the First Amendment and a mere mental or emotional injury under traditional tort law and under the Prison Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Finally, as the panel has pointed out, this is a pro se complaint. We're judging it according to pleading standards, and Mr. Wilcox is, of course, entitled to a liberal construction of those standards since he filed pro se and because he brought a civil rights claim. That, I see my time is up, and I'll conclude, Your Honors.
Well, we appreciate very much your undertaking representation of Mr. Wilcox. Thank you, Professor Shapiro. We'll come down and recounsel and then go into our next case.